It's February 5th, and as Rabbi Kelman said, today will be the last class on Rabbi Bamberger. So let me finish up first with the things that I had not so much on my table in the back, and then move into Rabbi Bamberger. The first thing, I've had this for I don't know how long. I listened to an earlier class, and I think I said, if I recall, because that's why I kept what I'm going to show you, that we are talking about S and Shin and Sin and Lithuania. They didn't do that. And of course, already you see in Sefer Shoftim. In fact, I'll show you here. Second. Let's see. Sefer Shoftim. This is in chapter 12. In verse Vav 6, it says, they said to them, say Shibboleth. And when he said Shibboleth, he couldn't pronounce it, so that's what Ephraim, they couldn't pronounce it, so they knew that they could kill him. So one of you commented, and I think I said that I don't know of any evidence that this continued in the Talmudic times. I don't know. However, what I should have mentioned is that in medieval times we had the same thing. Here is Radak on this very pasuk, where Radak explains what's going on there, and then he says, explaining, Shin and Sin, this is like the people of France. Zek kamo anshei Tsarfat, she'enan mevnim likro ha'shin, v'korim otak kamo tafrafa. They pronounce the shin like a tuf without a dagesh, like a sin, like we do. We pronounce, tuf and suf. So here we see that they pronounce the shin. We see, for example, that the Radak is saying that they did not pronounce a tuf like a tuf. They pronounced it, well, like they did the shin, which would be like a s. I think that's worthy of note. And we see, if you look in the early writings, when they refer to Paris, well, how was Paris, how do we write it? It's written with a, not with a Zion. Classically, it's written with a sin. That they would have been, they would have pronounced it, they would pronounce it not with a shin, but with a sin. Next thing I want to do, a couple of people ask me, what's these decrees? If we do a class on German Orthodox, Hungarian Orthodoxy, we'll get into great detail, but I just want to read you off, because I mentioned it already a few times, and MJ Frankel has already commented a few times. These are the decrees that were made in Hungary, and this is what made you Orthodox in Hungary. Very different, of course, what we'll see in Germany, or what we have seen. Number one, nine decrees that were at this big conference they had in Michalowicz. You can't have a drasha b'lshon umos ha'olam, not in the vernacular. Last time I was in the Budapest synagogue, the drasha is still in Yiddish, except when there are a lot of Israelis, they do it in Hebrew, but Hungarian can't be done. Two, you can't enter a synagogue asher ein la bima be'emtza, which doesn't have a bima in the middle. Rabbi Hartman, I see you now. I don't know if you were there when I greeted you a minute ago, saying how happy I was to see you this weekend, but this raises a question about the Sharon Shul. The bima's in the middle, but it's in the middle between the men. That is, the bima is in the back. It's a shul that the mechitza is at the back for the men. So the bima is in the middle because it's at the back of the men's section. So if you look at the whole shul, it's in the middle, but it's not in the middle of the men's section. So is that considered bima be'emtza or not? It's a good question. I don't know if the Hungarians, if they would step into the shul. I'm not sure. They have to determine. You can't make a base knesses b'migdal, like a tower. I think it means like a steeple, maybe. Four, you can't have malbushim miyuchadim l'shatz u'mashorim. You can't have special clothes for the chazan and the mashorim. Naftali mentioned this. This is not a choir. I'm not exactly sure the difference between a mashorer and a choir, but we'll see there's a difference. They can't wear special garbs, which will be domim l'shar nimusei datot, that are similar to others. So we know in Germany they wore these gowns. Forbidden. Five, you can't make a mechitza that you can see the women. We spoke about this, that you have to have the lattice work. And when I say mechitza, it's up there. Here's six. Asur lishmoa tefillah choir. You can't even go in to listen to the choir. Certainly, you can't daven with them and say amen. And if you're forced by this to daven biyachidus, stay home. Seven, shuls that are called choir shuls, you can't enter it. Not only to hear it, you can never enter it even during the week. So those of you coming with me to Central Europe this summer, if you have good Hungarian stock, it's not me saying this, Schneer Wyman, he has a tape I listened to when he brought a group to Budapest once. It's on YU Torah. He says, all of you from this Hungarian Orthodox background, we're going into the Duhani Synagogue. You stay outside because that's your... Of course, he meant it jokingly because no one's staying outside. You cannot step foot in such a shul like that, according to them. Eight, asur lahamira chuppa b'beis haknesses rak tiyatach hashamayim. No weddings in the shul. And ninth, and this is what the ninth decree was. By the way, some of the rabbis didn't like this. The Maram Shik said he didn't agree with all this, but since the other rabbanim said you have to do it, he has to go along with them. Azuriel Hildesheimer battled against this, but when he saw he wasn't getting anywhere, I guess he decides to leave Hungary and go to Germany. But listen to the last one, and I'm wondering why you need the other eight when you have the last one. Asur l'shanos shum min ha-gehadus. You can't change any Jewish practice. Oshum nimus besa knesses, asher makuba mavoseinu v'avos avoseinu. Basically, you can't make any changes in anything. So as long as you have that, then you don't really need the other ones. But okay, they wanted that. That sums it up. I said last class, we spoke briefly about mila, bris mila for people, in an intermarried couple. Can you, the father's not Jewish, the mother's Jewish, the father wants the child to be circumcised even though he's not being converted. Can you do it? And I said, and that was a dispute I mentioned between Azuriel Hildesheimer and Ratzirish Kalischer. And I said, I find it hard to believe that in Israel today they would allow this. The Moel in America, it's sort of like a free-for-all. Anyone could become a Moel. But in Israel, it's regulated, I gather. So Ben investigated it. Thank you, Ben. He says the rabbinate officially bans this type of brit mila. If someone, a moal or doctor, goes and does it, he can, but the official policy is no bris when the mother's not Jewish. I guess that means that you're not going to get punished by the government if you do it, but it makes sense. You're going to start giving bris mila to people who are for a moal. If they want to do it themselves, they can do it themselves, but that creates an implication. You could say that they're Jewish. Okay, Rabbi Shalom Berger writes in, and he says that I mentioned Ramosha, he uses the word member and electricity instead of chaver, and I don't know if I said electricity, I think I said car, and Rabbi Yellen said also machine. He says that Ramosha certainly knew the words, but I was told that he was reluctant to use words like chaver and hashmal because they have meanings in biblical and rabbinic Hebrew that derive from their modern usage. Well, I actually searched on Otzer Chachma. Rav Moshe uses both of them. He uses Chaver. So, for instance, I'm looking at a tshuva in Yeridea, volume 1, number 53. It's Shiloh. He says, uvedvar liyos chaver bevad harabani. So Rav Moshe used both member and chaver. I guess it depends what year, maybe. And he also uses chashmal. He uses electri and chashmal. So Rav Moshe was not like, these Eda Haredi types that refused to use the word chashmal because, I don't know, either Ben Yehuda created it or the Language Academy. He uses chashmal. I guess it just depended what was on his mind. And finally, one more thing from Rabbi Berger. And this will end with, call your attention to something about repeating words. Rabbi Berger says, I think he's spoken on Torah Moshe before, right, Rabbi? Yeah. He says, anyone who davened at Yeshivas Haratzion and heard Rav Amital as Chazan can attest that he led the Tzibor in multiple repetitions of the word, the Ne'emar, during Chazaras Hashatz on Yamim Noraim. When he was asked about this practice, why he's repeating it, he said, Kach nahogu b'Hungaria k'shayiti tzair. Growing up in Hungary, this is what he heard. So, if you're a Litvish guy, you could say back to Rav Amital, okay, so you heard it. Big deal, you heard it. We know from the Aruch HaShulchan, and we'll see in Ramosha that people did it, but the Rabbanim didn't. Who said the Rabbanim liked it? But if you know Rav Amital, he's very attached to the masses. I wonder if he's influenced by Rav Kook. In my forthcoming book, I speak about Rav Kook. sees in certain respects the hamonam, the masses, as standing above the Torah scholars. It's really very subversive, what Rav Kook says. But it could be Rav Amital is getting some of this, but like, for example, a famous story I'll tell you about Rav Amital, which recorded in the book that came out after his death, when his son was being bar mitzvah. I think that's Rav Yoel Amital. He's at Yeshiva Shalvim. So this is Rav Amital Sr. is the grandson-in-law of Rav Zalman Meltzer, one of the great Gedolei Yisrael. So when his son was bar mitzvahed, all the rabbis came and everything, and they're all saying, my bracha to the grandson, to the son, Rav Amital's son, I bless you, etc. You should follow in the path of your great, your Avta Zaidi, your great grandfather, Rav Zalman Meltzer. Everyone was saying that to the bar mitzvah boy, you have such yichus, and we hope that you follow in his path. And Rav Amital gets up and says, I have to say, after hearing all these people wishing that my son will be like Rav Zalman Meltzer, following the path, I have to say that that's not my wish. My father wasn't a Gadol Yisrael. The people I was grew up with weren't Gadol Yisrael. What my bracha to my son is that he be an Erech Jew. That's what I want him to be. And then later he can become a Talmud Chacham. But the primary bracha, I want him to bracha, I want him to be Erech. And so Rav Amital, it fits in with Rav Amital. But I do want to tell you about a few words, just about repeating words, and I'll tell you where Moshe says, because I think it's really interesting. I mentioned it last class, but I was doing by memory, and I was happy to see that I actually remembered it perfectly. Sometimes I remember it 90% or even less. If you look in Ibras Moshe, Or HaChaim 2, Volume 2, Number 22, he's asked the question, Chazonim tevos Chazonim who repeat. And Rav Moshe says, it's just like the Aruch HaShulchan. He says, Ein ruach hachamim noch mehem. That is, the rabbis are not happy about this. They don't like it. However, and he says that the rabbis have already protested about this. It's not the first thing the rabbis protested to people didn't listen to. And he says, V'loho ilum. It didn't help. So it's really amazing that we have to understand why is it for a century the rabbis protesting this, it didn't help. And then all of a sudden, like in the late 80s, people start listening to the rabbis. I guess it's a sign of Meir Soloveitchik's thesis that the book culture versus the communal culture, the mimetic culture. In any event, so the rabbis today should stop complaining that no one listens to them. When you see that Rav Moshe and Aruch HaShulchan, they say no one listens to us, but today they do listen, and you don't even need the rabbi. You have all the machers in shul. If you try to repeat the words, they'll tell you. So Rav Moshe says even Chazanim Shomrei Torah do this. And he says, technically, it's not a problem, Rav Moshe says. It's not the best thing, but it's not a problem. So what's the difference? That means, he tells someone not to, but if he does it, you don't have to make a big deal about it. He says, why? There's no hefsek here. There's only a hefsek. He said, there's no hefsek if you just repeat and do it in the Seder of Tefillah. And he gives an amazing proof for this, Rav Moshe. If you're davening, let's say you're davening Shmona Esrei, and you're saying Shema Kolenu Hashem Elokeinu Chus V'Rachem Aleinu, and all of a sudden, as you're davening, you realize, you're daydreaming. You say the words. We all have this experience, just like you're driving. You don't know how you got to someplace, but you're there. We're davening. All of a sudden, you look at where you are, and how'd you get there? Because your mind wasn't on it. You're supposed to repeat it. If I said Shema Kolenu Hashem Elokeinu Chus V'Rachem Aleinu, and I realize my mind wasn't focused, it's fine. I go back and I repeat it. And Rav Moshe, and you're supposed to do that. And Rav Moshe says that he says, Vaday apa brachos yotzim b'gam. He says, even when it comes to brachos that you yotzei, even without kavana, what does he say? You should go back and say it. That shows it's not a hefsek. Because if it was a hefsek, I wouldn't be able to go back and repeat it. Because at the end of the day, I'm Yotzei. If I say Shema Koleinu, Refa'einu, whatever I'm saying, V'rir Shalayim Yerchab Rachamim Tashuv, if I'm not really focusing 100%, I'm still Yotzei. It's not the best, but I'm Yotzei. So if it is Hefseg to repeat, then I wouldn't be able to. But Rav Moshe says, no, of course you're supposed to go back and repeat it with Kavana. That shows that it's not a Hefseg. And repeating, it depends on how you're repeating. Why? And then Rav Moshe says, However, if you skip words and change the order, and it gives an example that I have to say I never heard growing up. I mentioned certain things I heard, but here's, where is it? I pulled it up here. Here. This is the example Ramoshes gives in Shmona Esrei and Shabbos morning. Sorry, in the not Shmona Esrei in before Kriya Shema, Brachos Shema. I can say that I never heard a chazan sing this, but listen to Rav Moshe says that they would in the bracha of Yotzer. This is how they would pronounce it. We say kihu avedol po'og avaros ba'al mochamos. And what does Rav Moshe say? People would say this is how they would read it. Kihu avedol po'el gavaros. Kihu avedol osecha nashos. Kihu avedol ba'al mochamos. So there you have, you're repeating kihu levado with each little section there. That Rav Moshe says is forbidden, and that you can't do. And it's forbidden. The others, it's not the best thing. It's not a proper thing. But since we already see that it's not a proper thing, but it's not technically forbidden, we can imagine cases when even the rabbis wouldn't oppose it. And for this, I'm going to call your attention to a sefer called Toras Chaim by Rav Yaakov Sholem ben Chaim Sofer, a student of the Ksav Sofer, and he says as follows. This is on his section Or HaChaim, number 53. He says as follows. Let me pull it up here where I find it. He says that in the Sfarim, this is the mid-19th century, they've already criticized the Chazanim who sing Shalom Chavot Shemayim. That is, they're just doing it to put a concert on for their own voice. So that's the sort of thing that, you can't repeat words, it's wrong. And then he says, and in our generation, they're doing something even worse that they didn't do in previous generations, the Chazanim. They're now repeating words. So in previous generations, the Rabbanim criticized the Chazanim because they turned it into a show. Now they're doing worse, and they're repeating words. And he says in Shmona Esrei and Kedusha, and then he says that one time in front of my Rebbe, that's a Ksav Sofer, the Chazan repeated words in Kedusha, and Ksav Sofer Garbo emes Kedusha. He rebuked him in the middle of Kedusha. I'm not sure what, I guess. You're allowed to speak if you need to. So he told him, probably told him enough or whatever, in the middle of Kedusha. But then he says that there are those, he quotes the Maharam Shik, who also was against repeating words. He says, but I've heard people who reject them, Tshuvas the Maharam Shik, Shekama v'chama tzadiki mukdoshim alyonim, shehem tzibor. And what does he say? He says that we know that there are many tzadikim and great, kedoshi alyon, who when they are chazanim, kofling hatevos, they repeat the words. So how could the Maharam Shik be so negative about repeating words? We know great tzaddikim. And he says, well, no one criticized this me'olam. And so what does this sefer say here, the Toras Chaim? He says there's a difference. And he's explaining about the Maharam Shik. When the Maharam Shik criticizes them, he's criticizing people who are performing. And in performing, they repeat words. He doesn't mention Ramosha's point of going out of order, because even not going out of order, it's a problem, he's saying. But what he says, Misha kavana so shamayim, if your intention is for the sake of shamayim, umei rov havod of a kavana, and you're involved in your kavana, and therefore your kofal tevos, leka kveda. He says, if you do it as part of the spiritual, you say like Shema Koleinu, Shema Koleinu, something like that, you can imagine that's okay. And we know that the big Rabbanim used to do that, the Kadosh Elyon, he says. But the Chazanim who do it Shelo L'shem Shemayim, just so that they have a good voice, Be'enei Ha'am, in front of the people, that's usur. So, I mean, what we have here, and I told you, one of the rabbis in my community, he's since passed away, but he was not a modern Orthodox trained person. He lived in a modern Orthodox community, but he was more people. He wasn't himself. I wouldn't call him modern Orthodox. When I asked him as a chutzpahnik little kid, I asked him, "Why do you repeat the words?" I was before bar mitzvah. He says, "When the rabbanim say not to repeat words, they're not referring to what I'm doing." So what he meant was what I said. That is part of something to make the tefillah more meaningful, that would be okay. Now, would Ramosha doesn't make that distinction. Ramosha just says it's not appropriate, even though it's not forbidden. But we see and we know that there were many people who did it like this, and I don't know if Ramosha would oppose it if in a case like I mentioned just now, when it's not done as a performance or sort. Okay, funny. Let's write. Today I got an email from both my sons' yeshiva, a talk being given by Rav Dovidal Weinberg. I don't know if anyone knows this yeshiva to write to have or to be the religious implications of Eric Fromm's philosophy. Strange class to have at a yeshiva, I guess, by Eric Fromm. I mean, I looked him up. He's the great, I said he's what, the great grandson or something of Rav Bamberger, but I say he's an atheist, but he must have religious implications. I know nothing about Eric Fromm, but I mentioned him last time. So I see that Rav Dovidal, who a really interesting person, Rav Dovidal Weinberg, that he's the brother of Rav Moshe Tzvi Weinberg, he is the Mashgiach at YU. But he published a volume of Rav Kook's writings. Interesting person. Okay, I want to now, in our concluding words about Rabbi Bamberger, this will take us to the end. I want to just continue with a few other things I want to call your attention to. Rabbi Bamberger, obviously, old German family, and he kept very strongly to German minhagim, even in examples when other people did not hold so strongly. So, for instance, people in his kehillah wanted to introduce the Sephardic practice, which became common in Eastern Europe, that everyone says Kaddish together, and he opposed this. I wonder, are there, other than the Germans, are there any shuls we have today that, I assume Washington Heights doesn't do it, but the old Ashkenazic practice was one person says Kaddish. Each Kaddish, one person would say it. Not like us, where it's a free-for-all, we all say it. And in the best places, the mourners will at least stand together or near each other, and you try to say it at the same time. Otherwise, people are finishing at all different times. But I wonder, we have some Washington Heights people. Do they still hold to the old German practice of one Kaddish? Someone will type it in
Yes,
for me. I'm
only
curious.
one person says Scottish.
Yes.
Only one person says Kaddish. Okay. How it happened that all the rest of us who are from Lita and Poland and Romania, how we adopted, I guess people, they, everyone wanted, you know what? In the popular mind, Kaddish is important to raising the neshama. So therefore you could see why people would say that, we all want an opportunity to say Kaddish. What do you do during the week? They pick one person each morning minion?
No. There's one person says Kaddish,
Yeah.
and there are three Kaddishim that are said.
Yeah.
And if the and on those days, if there are a lot of latecomers or they need another Kaddish, except for Monday and Thursday, before Chazaras HaShatz, another will say Chatzi Kaddish and then say Baruch Hu before they begin Chazaras HaShatz. But if you
No, but
take
let's say you have five availing. Who determines who gets it? Okay. Okay, so I can see if someone's not going to say Kaddish, he'll miss out. He'll
Sometimes
be
by
upsetting
age,
too.
there's a whole kadima in
Yeah.
the Flamed Beis.
Okay, you need good gadayim in our shuls. No one knows. Everyone just comes in and says it. Nikki, yeah.
It was my understanding that Ashkenazim switched to the Sephardic system because there were actual fistfights in shuls, and the Rabbanim got together and decided that was it. And they agreed to switch to the Sephardic system. There were actual physical fistfights in
Makes
shul.
sense, because I know that you have a number of tshuvos that discuss this, who has the kedima? Who's, just like today we wonder who davens for the omelet, there's tshuvos, who should say Kaddish? So and especially when you throw in the idea, someone feels that it's important, he's giving respect to his parents. So I'm sure that's correct.
The Yavetz brings it down. He writes that in his introduction to his siddur, but in those three volumes we have from a Hamburger on
Yeah.
Yeshiva, go to the second volume on Westphalia, on the development of how it became throughout West, Eastern and Western Europe that more than one person said Kaddish because it was part of the Napoleon's decrees, fraternity equality. And what's the
That's right. I remember Hamburger because the quasi-reform rabbi in Westphalia, he instituted that also. Yes. Okay. There was a practice in Würzburg that not just Würzburg, other places in Germany. We have Shchita. We all know what Shchita is, right? And you ask everyone, they say that Jews, religious Jews, cannot eat any meat from the hindquarters, and therefore we don't have that. But it's not true. You're allowed to eat meat. You just have to get rid of the fat, the chaylev. It's called nikur, and nikur was done throughout history. It's still being done. You go to Israel, you can go to El Gaucho, other places. Here, look. The OU doesn't do it, but you can go here. You want to get it? Bisra meats, highest quality kosher hindquarter meats by Rabbi Aviad Elkin, under the hashgacha of Rabbi Elio Ben Chaim. And you can buy it if you want. Rav Moshe says there's no issue. Rav Moshe says there's no minhag not to eat it. It's just that it does not worth the effort because they would sell it. They could sell it to the non-Jews. So it's not worth the effort and people didn't want it. He says there's no minhag not to eat it. It's just that people did it. If it was a minhag for Ashkenazi not to eat it, then it would be a problem to start eating it. Rav Moshe says there's no minhag in Israel. It's under hashgacha. What I would only say is that Rav Moshe is speaking about Lithuania, other places in Germany, in some places there, as far as I can tell, there was indeed a minhag not to eat it. Maybe because it's hard and you need to be trained for it. And we know that there were some kahilos that wanted to institute nikur because everyone used to do it. If you want to learn about this thing, this porging, the word is porging, P-O-R-G-E. As far as I know, the word porge only means one thing, to remove the fat in kashrus. So I don't know who invented this word, this English word, porging. If this is a big deal in the controversy over shchita in England, because in England they would sell meat that wasn't porged, and it was your responsibility to go. You'd go to the butcher, you'd buy the meat there, and then you had to go next door inside the butcher shop. You'd have to go to the guy whose job, the menacher, the porger. And this was the system that was under the Hashgacha, even under Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky, although eventually he got rid of it. And the idea was that you take it yourself and go, no different than when we were all growing up. You'd see the meat in the store. It would be your job to kosher it when you get home. Today, no one knows how to kosher anything. They don't even allow meat to be sold that isn't kosher. The problem was that a lot of these people would go to the store, they'd buy the meat, and they'd figure, well, it's shechted, and then they would just take it home and eat it without it being porged. So if you look here on Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky, a number of years ago, wrote this article. He has these articles in Jewish Action. So he writes about Nikor and the whole practice of Nikor, and he deals with the Jerusalem and Rav Moshe and Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. And okay, you don't. And he states at the end that Rav Moshe says it's a sin to forget a section of the Torah. So Ari Zivotofsky says that therefore, if we forget the laws of Nikor, that's a sin. You can get it in Philadelphia as well. So if you want tenderloin, you want sirloin, you want the real thing that the goyim like, I'm a chicken person. I go to steakhouse, I get chicken, so I was never much attracted to it. But Bamberger is opposed to it. He says, let me read you. This is mentioned. Hamburger in his biography of Rabbi Bamberger, page 565, he says he has a statement there. He says that our forefathers nagu iser l'nakerach. He says that we do have a practice, a minhag, unlike what Rav Moshe says. And he says this is he thought because they saw that a michshala could arise. That is, you have to be expert, and not everyone is expert at it. And therefore, we have enough meat as it is. Well, why take the chance? But what he's doing is he's upholding the German minhag. That's what Rav Bamberger is doing. He's not inventing this on his own. He's saying this was the minhag. Unlike Rav Moshe, the Rav Moshe in Lithuania and Russia, they did do nikur. So
Rav
I don't
Bamberger
know. I
was
don't.
safer on Shechita Kol Moreh L'Zvachim.
Yeah. I don't know if he even deals with Nikor because they didn't do Nikor. So, yes, he has a sefer, and we spoke about that actually. Thank you. Then the minhag in German, among at least in his area of Germany, was not to do weddings on Rosh Chodesh Sivan during Sfira. Again, people wanted to get rid of it. But at least, I, as far as I know, in us non-German Jews, we do do it on Rosh Chodesh. Don't we do it on Rosh Chodesh weddings? Yes. Okay. So he's really standing al ha-mishmar, as they said, protecting German minhagim. But he had many of his own minhagim. In fact, not just minhagim, but hanhagot is the term, maybe pious things beyond the letter of the law, something which no one else would be required to do in his mind, but he did it because of his special piety. In Homburger's biography, he lists, I don't know, like some 50, no, 86 of these practices. Let me just read you a couple of them, a few of them. Number 30 on his list. Do you know that Rabbi Bamberger did not eat gebrots? From the time that they started with, I know when they started with machine matzah, which he thought is much better, then he permitted his household to eat it, but he never did. In other words, he thought there's always a big problem about matzah. Is machine matzah better? Many of the rabbis opposed machine matzah among the Hasidim, but the non-Hasidim said, on the contrary, machine matzah is better. It's more kosher. So when they only had hand matzah, but Rabbi Bamberger's house, they would not eat because the fear is it gets wet. Maybe there's something in there, and then it leads to chametz. There's something inside the matzah wasn't totally baked. But when they had machine matzah, which was 100% better as far as he's concerned, everyone else could eat now gebrachs, but he did not eat gebrachs. What are the Ashkenazic rabbanim? Don't eat gebrachs. Now, you guys who go to your Pesach programs, have your Pesach programs, you can't have gebrachs because they want to appeal to the Hasidim. But there's still some good Pesach programs there that are proudly following the Vilna Gaon, the Mishnah Berurah, Rav Moshe, and the rest of them. And, we get our matzah balls. We're not falling into that trap, which kashrus often is, that you have to raise the standard so much so that you get everyone, which means that I already told you about peanuts. Once the OU stopped certifying peanuts and peanut oil, you should bring, if you're from Lithuania or one place that had peanuts, you should bring peanuts to your Seder table each night and hand them out. Otherwise, everyone's minhag is going to be no peanuts. So, but that's an example of the sort of pious things that all our gadolim have these practices. Every gadol I know of has individual pious practices that they do, and they don't tell anyone else to do it. And that's an interesting one. Let me read you a couple more. Number 40 on the list. He was makpid to sleep in the sukkah even in his older age, and he didn't rely on the heter that it's cold. And Germany can be cold, sukkahs. And he insisted on sleeping there, even as an elderly man. That wasn't really the general practice, but we're not, that's what he did. He could have had a heter, but he didn't want it. Number 66, and this I love. I wonder if our Germans, our Yekis, can give us other examples of this because I didn't know about this. He called, he had a lot of sons, we saw. One of his sons he called Yitzhak. How could he call his son Yitzhak? He's Yitzhak. No, he's Yitzhak Dov. He called his son Yitzhak. I don't know what middle name he had because that was the name of his father-in-law. And as long as he doesn't call him Yitzhak Dov, it's okay. You can call him Yitzhak. And we know that in the note here it says that among the continued descendants in his family, they continued his practice on Hefa name, not a full name. You don't name a full name, but for us, it would be very strange because we don't really usually use the second name. A couple other of these practices of Rav Bamberger. Look at, here's number 77. He was makpid. I don't want to offend anyone here. He was makpid that women should not go to the cemetery during the Levaya. And you know that this is, or maybe you don't know, this is a practice in certain German cemeteries, in the cemetery in Zurich, for instance. I think there are cemeteries in Jerusalem. Did Rabbi Bamberger invent this? Not at all. Let me show you something. Here, where are we here? I pulled it up before. Shulchan Aruch. And the Ramah doesn't disagree. Yeshlim Women should be withheld from following the bier to the cemetery. This is Yoredeya 359. Now, what's this based on? It's actually based on a Zohar. It says that if men look at the women when they return from the cemetery, you know, that cemetery, I'll get you in a second, Nikki, just a second, it causes some men to die before their time. So I've been to lots of funerals, unfortunately. I've never been to a cemetery where women don't go, but I know there are. What, Nikki? Yes.
I'm from Belgium, and I was not permitted to go to my mother's burial, to the cemetery, and the Belgian, the Manhattan Chevra Kedisha is from Manhattan, New York, you know, from the Moria, will not permit women to go Ad Hayom Hazeh, including
a funeral.
To the basic farm, to the cemetery.
You mean, go to the cemetery even when it's not a funeral?
Yeah, no, when the funeral go, you go to the funeral,
okay.
But then you're not permitted to go actually to the burial. You cannot go on the cemetery itself.
Now, well, where was your mother buried? In Belgium or over the border?
No, right in Westbury, Beth Israel Cemetery.
Okay, no, because in Belgium, I know they go over the border and they bury them. They can't bury them now in Antwerp. They bury them over the border. Yeah.
No, this was in
America. Yeah. Okay. So that's news to me in America. I didn't even know about this. Does Washington Heights do this?
I don't know, but I know that Maria.
I don't know. We have a Washington Heights person. You can tell us if they do that. I don't know. I haven't heard about Washington Heights. So.
In general, the women do not go to the Beis HaKvaros for the kibbutz.
Okay, this is really interesting. And he held this.
In Monk Shul in London, for many years, I don't know what the practice is now, but certainly until about 30 years ago, it was the practice that women could not go to the cemetery for a burial. And there was a certain figure who, his name I won't mention, internationally known, who had only daughters. And when he passed away, there was a huge row between the rabbi and the daughters at the just before the burial, because the daughters demanded that they be allowed to go.
You know, in Israel, there was a problem because some of these Chevra Kedisha didn't allow women to speak, and there was a revolt in the last 20 years. And, you know, if you're going there, it's your parent. Who are these people? And they can't tell you what to do. And I know that now, basically, they stand off to the side. They don't interfere. I've heard this from people who told me that what the difference today and what they used to. And also, there were places in Israel they didn't let sons. Now, only the firstborn son would not go to the basic pharaohs for the funeral. This has to do with Kabbalistic things. I think it's only the firstborn son, although I forget. Meir Benayahu has a whole long, long essay on this practice. It has to do with, well, I don't need to get into the details, but children who weren't born and are going to take their revenge. And finally, the last one, Hikpid al Gezel Goy. He was very makpid, as all German Orthodox Jews, in matters of Dine Mamonot. He was very careful on thievery of non-Jews. So much so, and what I'm going to tell you now, it's said about the Chafetz Chaim also, when he sent a letter through a messenger that is not by sending it in the post, just gave it to someone, he would rip up the stamp. I mean, which is strange. And the same strange about the Chafetz Chaim also. They said the Chafetz Chaim did the same thing, but why would you rip up the stamp? You only use a stamp when you send it through the post office. If you're not through the post office, then what's the point? You're not using anything. So what's the answer they say about the Chafetz Chaim? I guess it applies here. It's a chassidus. You know, it's a type of chassidus. I can't understand. It's beyond me. I can't even approach that level, but it's a type of chassidus that they feel in a certain sense they're stealing from. It's hard for us normal people to understand this, but people of a much higher madrega than us, you know, they see things that we don't see. A couple other things I want to mention. And this might upset some of you who are very much into Tanakh, because one of the great, great figures, my son is actually infatuated with him. He's doing a senior thesis, I think, at YU on him, is this individual. Samuel David Lozzato, Shmuel David Lozzato, known as Shadal. I think there's another picture. Here's a picture of him. I remember the first time I learned about Chagall was through Nachama Leibowitz. She would cite him a lot. What a commentator. What a genius, genius of genius, Chagall. We should have classes on him. Such a fascinating individual. They're reprinting all his Sfarim now in Israel. This guy, Bashai, I think his name is. And J.J. Kimchi, who runs the podcast, The Jewish Ideas. I highly encourage everyone to listen to it. He is coming out with a translation of, with notes of Chagall's Vikuach, his work on Kabbalah, Vikuach on Kabbalah. So when Chagall was a great defender of traditional Judaism against the attacks. He went a little far. He attacks the Rambam, but he attacks the Reformers. He had all sorts of strange sayings. He said that we're interested in Tanakh, T-N-A-K, not Kant, K-A-N-T. And he battled against Geiger and the rest of them. However, he had views that are unquestionably either borderline orthodox or even non-orthodox, and which he published. And when he passed away, Rabbi Mazuz, we just saw the pasuk I showed you earlier, from which we read during Davini, Osa Chadashas Baal Mochamos. That's what Ramazuz says about Chagall, that he does mochama, which is good against the reformers, but he also makes his own chadashos, new things. So when Chagall passed away, I think he passed away 1865, as I recall. I'll see right now. I'll check. 1865 is my recollection. Yes. So there was all sorts of articles about him, his greatness, including in Halev Anon. Halev Anon was an orthodox, important orthodox paper that all the Gedolim and thinkers used to publish in. And Rabbi Bamberger publishes an open letter, I have it right here, in which he says that I want to point something out. And that's, although you had this, you know, the eulogy about Chagall, and you portray them as Echad Mitzadiki v'chassidei G'onei Ador. And he says, I just want to point out some things to you that he writes that would show you that he's not, we should not regard him as one of the chassidei G'onei Ador. And it's true, it's Chagall's a great figure, but to put him in the category of Gedolim when he says things that are, you know, that are controversial, let's put it that way. And it's, you know, he mentions this, even though when he deals with Wesley, Neftali Hirsch Weisel, here he is, one of the people from the Mendel Solomon circle. Here's Weisel. He refers to him as Hachacham refers to Weisel, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So Rabbi Bamberger loved Wesley. On the other hand, he had a problem with Chagall, which is unusual, I think. The last thing I want to mention, and then I'll get to your comments, is in his tshuvos. I was going to go give other examples of the tshuvos, but then, you know, I said I want to finish. We want to finish it today. 12 classes, it's enough. I mean, we could do many more, but I think we got a good understanding of him. But listen to this one. In one of the shuls in Germany, you had one levy. In the little community. Germany sometimes had small communities. He didn't want to pay membership. Whatever reason, maybe he was in a fight. He's going to shul, but he's not paying up his dues. I mean, we could have that in our shuls. We don't have kehilos like they used to have, but, you know, we have minyanim. Sometimes people come to shachris. Okay, they come for a week, a month, etc. If they've been coming now for 6 months, if they don't want to be a member, someone's going to go up to them and say, well, you know, you got to make a donation. You can't just come every, you know, that's how the shuls exist. Okay, well, this guy didn't want to pay his membership. And the shul said, we don't want to call him up for levy. We just want to do kohen either, you know, so you can do kohen twice or just kohen and Yisroel. You do kohen twice. We don't want to call him up for levy because he's not a member of our kehila. And Rabbi Bamberger says, you still have to call him up after Cohen. You can take action against him. You can, if he's obligated to, I think as I recall, he says you can, this is in Yad HaLevi, Orach Chaim number 16, volume 1. I think he even says you can go to the government because if he's a member of the community, he has to pay. You can do whatever you want to do to try to force him to pay. But if he's sitting there, you have to give him Levi. because it's not him per se. It's the it's his tribe, I guess. He gets it. Let me see the comments and questions, and then I'll say some. Well, first, before I see the comments and questions, I don't want to forget. I thank you all again for being with me for these 3 months, 12 classes. I think it was really great learning about Rabbi Bamberger. I never thought we'd do 12 classes. Granted that about five of those classes or six of them were dealing with Austrit, but since he is so connected to Austrit, it was very important to get into that. Jacob says, wasn't a Radox Ta Rafa more like a Th in Thumb? I always assume so, but the problem is that he says here that that's before I saw what he says, that they pronounce the shin with the sin, as we call it. They pronounce it like the Taf. Were they pronouncing the shin? You know what? I'm going to look for next class when I'm going to look and see what the scholars have to say about Radox. That's the Ammonites would say that. But I'll see what I can find out about Radok, his tough without Agesh. But I don't think so, based upon that Radok. But we'll see. Rabbi Hartman says, a major Orthodox shul in the Bronx, not Eden Jewish Center, like David Hollander, did not have Bima in the center. Well, there's a lot of Orthodox shuls don't have it. Rav Moshe was asked about this. And Rav Moshe said, the Hungarians made a decree, because they were in the battle against the reform, and the reform were changing it. But if you're not part of, if you're not today, it's not relevant, Ramosha said, because we're not battling against the reformers over Bima Bemtza. So when you speak halacha lemaisa, unless I guess you're Hungarian and you're attached to this, it's not an issue anymore. The Rambam says Bima Bemtza, but the Kesef Mishnah says that's because they can hear you best there. But it's not halacha. So I granted, if you're Hungarian, it's an issue, and we know that, some people maybe have an issue, but we have lots of Orthodox shuls that don't have the Bima in the middle. Chaim says, as to forbidden Migdalim, per Rav Adam Mintz, one of the things Reform wanted and did was build shuls with bell towers. Yes, they did. I mentioned that when in the Reform classes, I mentioned that. And so I think that's what the Migdal is here, the steeple, even though they wouldn't have bells. Exactly. But here it's better because in Pressburg, where the Ksav Sofer was, they rebuilt the shul, and lo and behold, they built it with like a belt tower, a tower of sorts. But it was too. Once they realized what's going on, that there was a tower that the Ksav Sofer said it would cost too much money to destroy it. He allowed it to go up, even though he was very unhappy with it. Rabbi Yellen says the Maram Shik would not sign the letter from the Rabbanim that anyone who violated the Hungarian Tikkus was a terrible person. Yes, the Maram Shik went along with it, but he didn't take the to the extreme. You say, I think that kind of said they were like Ovdei Avodah Zara or some other very derogatory term. Well, it goes on for a couple pages. And let me see, I have here the page. They say, I don't know if it says Avodah Zara or just like you reject God or something like that. I don't know the exact language. I don't want to take a. They speak about, you know, that these new people are coming. They're violating the law. They're the Yetzer Hara. They want to be like the non-Jews, like the Goyim. They want to akor das Yehudis. So anyone who's not putting the bima in the middle or wearing the gown, you're trying to uproot Torah Judaism. You're violating, it says, following in the paths of the non-Jews. Etc. Etc. They might even say, well, they're saying they're following like the non like the Christians. So that's I guess you could call the Avodah Zarah exactly. The Maram Shik in Hungary was in the middle. He was actually a moderate. The extremists were people like Gil Lichtenstein and believe it or not, you know who signed this? The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Shlomo Gottfried was one of the extremists. Rav Israel Hildesheimer was on the left. So when you think about it here, you have Israel Hildesheimer on the left, the Maram Shik in the middle as a moderate, but the extremists won. And he said that he has to go along with them. Phil Lichtenstein was so extreme that when the extremists in Jerusalem put his son-in-law, the Leif HaIvri, the Rekiv Yosef Sessions, are in Cherem, rather than come to his son-in-law's defense, he says, I have to investigate, see what's going on here. Why they put him in Chayram, you know? Because maybe he put him in Chayram too, I guess. Rav Hill Lichtenstein writes, another moderate is the Kasav Sofer in Pressburg. Rav Hill Lichtenstein writes a terribly strong letter to Rav Hill Lichtenstein, to the Kasav, about Pressburg. One to the Kasav Sofer and one to someone else. And he writes about Pressburg. He goes, Echa haya, like the words Echa. How did this great city, Pressburg, become what it became? Because in Pressburg, the Kasav Sofer appointed a German language preacher. And his own father, and in his ethical will, said you can't have a vernacular preacher. This the decree which we read, Michailovitz, that in that matter was just repeating what the Chasam Sofer said. And the Kasav Sofer goes against his father, but the Kasav Sofer said, if my father was alive, you know, he would have also appointed, because he can't appoint. It's like today having a Yiddish preacher in a show where no one speaks Yiddish. But so they were very angry. You know, the Kasav Sofer brought Israel Hildesheimer and he wanted him to be assistant rabbi. Rabbi Kelman says, might Rav Kook have been influenced by Solomon Schechter and Catholic Israel? He wasn't. It's a very similar idea, but he didn't know about Solomon Schechter. I'm sure of that. But you can derive this. He knew about Frankel. We said Frankel spoke about the same thing in the classes on Frankel. I gave you an example where Rav Kook says the same thing Zachariah Frankel said. I also don't think he's influenced by Frankel. It's in the Gemaras, the idea of a holy community. And someone sent me something from a Breuer on the Shul Choir, but I'll take a look at it afterwards. I still don't know if you know what's the difference between a Meshorer and a choir. I'm not sure what the difference is.
The Meshorerim were part of the tefillah with the chazan. They sang along with the chazan during the tefillah per se. The choir was an accompaniment for the kahal to participate in the tefillahs and sing together. But the Meshorim were standing next to the chazan and part of the tefillah, the chazos hashatz, and the actual tefillah.
Okay, like so you're saying the choir? If the choir is just being with the chazan, that's not a choir.
No, the choir is an accompaniment for the whole shul to be able to sing.
I didn't know that. Thank you. I've been wondering this. Thank you.
I think you'll see that in the article.
Yes, Chaim Soloveitchik wrote about mimesis exactly. And someone says, tell me privately to look at Leon Wieseltier's book, Kaddish. Leon Wieseltier wrote a book all about Kaddish. I know Leon Wieseltier. And Rabbi Kelman says, Webster's dictionary defines porridge to make a slaughtered animal ceremonially clean by removal of the forbidden fats, sinews, according to Jewish ritual. Yes, but someone in England had to invent this word porridge when they decided to do Nikkur. And it doesn't have any other meaning. It's like you can't use the word porridge to remove veins, just because if you're Italian and you want to do it, it's only Jewish ritual is porridge. While I'm doing this, if you can try to get the etymology, I don't know. If not, I'll get it later. Paul says, oh, here it is. Paul says, thank you, Paul. Oxford English Dictionary, the origin is Yiddish portion. So what does that mean, portion? Removal, I guess, from the word like lefrosh or something, maybe? Parish? That we know that we have the word parish, separate. Okay, it seems unlikely. It's a bit of a stretch, but I don't know. And Bina says, a lot of Hasidim don't allow women to burials. Thank you for that. I didn't know. And Paul says, back in England, until about 10 years ago, only United Synagogue rabbis were allowed to speak at funerals. You mean the children could not speak? Even the male children? It's good I can say they got rid of that formality. Yeah, you know, it's, Jacob says, regarding sons going to father's funeral, it's not just firstborn sons, it's all children. Okay, thank you, Jacob. It's not all children, it's all sons. The issue is sons. As far as it's not the daughters, at least not the what I'm thinking about. Frankel MJ says, Shadal didn't have a problem with lower biblical criticism. There's a well-known emendation suggested from Yecheskel. Yes. He basically did not touch Torah, but Nach, he 100%, he was involved in emendations. Baron Kvodo. Baruch, I forget that one. Someone asked about what I made of postage stamps and the Chavetz Chaim. It's recorded in Sfarim about the Chavetz Chaim. Again, I don't know if it's a true story. The fact is, you have the exact same story about the, as we just saw, Rabbi Bamberger. Sometimes these Gedolim stories, you have the same story about four or five different Gedolim. So presumably it's right about one, but then it gets transferred to another one. As Beryl Wein said, we don't know if it happened, but we know they don't tell these stories about you and me. The same story is told about the Chavetz Chaim, that if he would give a letter to someone, like some, he's in Radin and someone's going to Kovno, he gives him a letter saying, deliver this to Rabbi Yochanan, he would take a stamp and throw it out. That's the story that's recorded. If you watch the video, on the Rav, I don't know if you can get it anymore. They should put it online now. The Rav, the hour long, hour and a half, documentary, whereby J.J. Schachter tells a story that, the Rav said, you know, he met someone and someone asked him, like, when do you have time to do all the secular studies? And he said, during the time when you guys are talking about me, that's when I learn it. Well, I know that, but that's really recorded about Israel Hildesheimer in Hungary, that one of the extremist Hungarian rabbis came to Hildesheimer and he was very impressed by him. He said, he's a Godel and Shas and Poskim. He says, how do you have time to, where do you know all the secular knowledge? He goes, all the time you guys are spending bad-mouthing me, that's when I'm doing secular studies. So, you see how these, stories get passed from one to the other. But it's not the Rav. I never heard the story about the Rav until J.J. Schachter mentioned that. The story about Rav Israel Hildesheimer is mentioned already. It's probably 100 years old. It's in the sources. So that's where it began. And Rabbi Kalman says Marty Lakshin gave talks on Shaddal and, Morris Feierstein. Yes, the funeral customs are Kabbalistically connected. Yes, thank you for that. Absolutely. And in fact, Ben Nayahu has a whole, it's more than an essay, it's a whole book, in which he deals with the idea of the sons, I think it's just the sons, not going to the funerals and all that sort of thing. Zev says, why did they ask the Kohanim to step out for a moment and then call up Yisrael? Good question. I don't know. It could be that in Germany you don't do this. In the Hasidic world, you don't just ask them, you can tell them. The Munchas Elazar has a tshuva there. He says that if you want, you can order the Kohen out. That is, you got to give it to this Yisrael. He gave good money or whatever it is. I don't know if in the German they would follow this practice of certainly not, you can't order people out, but even asking people to leave. I don't know if, but finally,
that would teach that lady a lesson.
It would. He doesn't mention it though, the Rabbi Bamberger. Daniel says that we got married in 2021 in LA and the shul, the rabbi followed the Hungarian and hugging. He wouldn't allow the chuppah to be in the sanctuary. And instead you had it in the social. You were the first wedding in that building. When you come to Hungary with me this summer, we'll see where they set it up outside. But look, there were people who were not even Hungarians. The Rav didn't like going to, or Salvager didn't like going to weddings inside synagogues. There's other people who didn't. But it's basically been accepted. And MJ Frankel has good yichus because his great-grandfather, Yatevlev of Siget, signed Hungarian Psak. But your great-great-grandfather was also refused to join the Orthodox organization. Because he thought that they were too, I guess, Ashkenazic, not Hasidic, right?
That's correct. However, when he and his son, the Kedushas Yontif, also was status quo until he wanted his son to succeed him, and then through some political machination, he agreed it was a political trade-off, and it's too complicated to.
Okay. Well, one day hopefully you'll tell me. But you know what? You say status quo, which is one thing. In the Belzer Rebbe moves to Munkach in the early part of 20th century. Yes. And oy, the Mahokas that went down there, he technically was a Neolog. He couldn't be Orthodox because the Munkacher was. So he technically became Neolog. And finally, last comment, Rabbi Shudnow says, Rabbi Ben Amozig was deep in Kabbalah, Shaddal was completely out of it, and Rabbi Ben Amozig wrote a whole sefer, Tam Lashad, against Shaddal. He showed him great respect, but against Shaddal in defense of Kabbalah, both in Italy. So with this, first time ever, we actually finished 9:31, close enough. Again, thank you very much. It was a great semester. I learned so much from all of you, like Pirkei Avos says, right? You learned most from the students, and at least in this hour, I learned from you. So you're my students, at least in this hour, but I learned so much from all of you. So I really enjoyed it very much. And Rabbi Kelman, final words.
Have a safe trip a good trip. You'll tell us all about it, and we'll resume either in 2 or 3 weeks. We will let you know when we hear. But as we mentioned right at the beginning, we'll be talking on the Musar controversy. But in the meantime, we'll have all our regular classes for the week, etc., but not next Monday night. And of course, I'll put up again. I've been sort of announcing our program on coping and resilience on Sunday. Unfortunate, I would say, whatever, but it's really, I think, some amazing speakers.
Very powerful. Yeah, and especially Rabbi Perez, Doran Perez. Doran Perez,
of course, who's tragically, you know, as I'm sure many of you know, his son is a hostage in Gaza. His other son got injured. That was the story, got married. You know, he was injured, then he got married, went back to the army, and one son is missing in Gaza. They think as a hostage. And of course, he's the one who put Mizrahi back on the map. Doron Perez has brought Mizrahi up. So we know him from our trip to South Africa many years ago. And of course, my wife's family is South African. So her first cousin is good friends with him. And, he's a great guy. And, this is obviously terrible what he's going through, but just in general. So he'll be speaking, Ellie Beer from United Hatzalah. Then we have psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. Really, it should be, whatever. It's an important program. So that'll be this Sunday from 9:15 to 15. Come for whatever you can come. Part of it, all of it.
You know, I say, Rabbi Kelman, someone asked me, I was watching this Naturi Karta, their rallies, and I said to this person, because he asked me about it, he's the one who sent me some of the videos. You know, we know you can identify a Jew, if the Rachmanim, if they identify the Jewish people. I wonder, halacha l'maisa, if you can count these people to a minyan, if you can rely on their kashrus. Anyone today who does not feel the pain can look at it and not feel like our world, you have to wonder if these people are Jewish or if it's just their customers.
My nephew, if I can say last, my nephew works at a startup in Toronto. They invest in Israel. The guy owns it, Israel. I don't know everything they're doing with some high tech stuff, whatever. And 30 people burst into their office this week. They have part of it on film. Half of them were Jews, non-Jews, you know, genocide, Palestine, and they filmed it. So they called the police. It took them 40 minutes to get there. Then the police, there wasn't any violence, but I saw some of the things. He said some of the people, one person was very shaken up. He was very calm. He was talking to them and trying to argue with them and whatever. It's really amazing. So they have a criminal lawyer now looking into it to see if they can press charges, whatever they are. They're covering their face, but half of them are Jewish. So I said to them, to Josh, I said, how is the Achenu B'nai Israel sort of half jokingly? So he said to me right away, I wouldn't consider them Achenu B'nai Israel. In other words, these are Jews supporting Palestine from the river to the sea and genocide and all the
support Hamas, walking with Hamas. And it's such a.
One of them said it's on tape. One of them said, he sent me whatever. My grandparents are survivors from the Holocaust. So big deal, like you said. I mean, whatever they said, that doesn't give you any credibility. It's sad. It's tragic. I don't know. It's terrible. I don't know anything more than anybody here. I think part of it is lack of education, but just a small part. I think some of these people, maybe not the nut cases, they don't know. Half the people don't even know what it means from the river to the sea. They have no understanding.
They have no idea. They've had them on video. They don't know what river, what sea. They don't know anything. Right.
Did you see?
But I just wanted to say that because the person might be listening who I said that I really. But the Naturi Karta is the worst because at least supposedly they're religious or they. It just means someone who doesn't have a Jewish heart. You could eat, drink Chalav Yisrael and super glad kosher, but if you don't feel the pain when you see parents who've lost a child, when you see Rav Maidan's son, no legs. I mean, and how he has such a piece of a friendly face and he's happy with it. But when that doesn't tear at your heart, they can't be Jews if you can look at that and not feel anything. That's what I answer to the person who asked me this question, that it's hard to see them as having any, you don't have to be religious. Most Jews are not religious, but we all know we come together at times because we feel for one another. If you don't feel, if you're a Porish Minat Sibor, Then you're not part of us. That's all I, that's Athenians deity, but okay, that's politics.
I agree. Listen, as Rav Soloveitchik pointed out many times, the first thing you say to a convert is to identify as a Jew. You know, if you know the Gemara in Yevamah there, of course, Gemara says,
because
you know,
they oppressed us, because we're oppressed.
And then if he says,
suffer.
Yes, Mekavli no Tomiyad, you immediately accept him, then you teach a mitzvah. But before mitzvah is the identification as a Jew. And that's
very important. That's a problem.
I'm sorry?
Okay. Does Satmar have the Turei Karta problem?
No, Satmar is different. Satmar cries over they would cry over, the Rebbe would cry. I mean, they're very upset. And any Satmar person I know, and I know a bunch of them, would feel the pain of the parents, 100%. They have a different Hashgatha, but these people don't care. They're different.
Okay. Well,
some are his problems, but they're not. We have to be honest with them. Okay, everyone, I'm off. So I have a lot of things I need to do still. God willing, God will watch over me, and I'll make
have
it back.
Have a great trip, Nishiyat Tova.
See you guys soon.
Great trip. Successful in Japan.
Be well, everybody. Looking forward to learning with you. We should hear good news. That's
Amen. Amen be amen.
The simplest for Bnei Israel. We should have Pesachah to celebrate. Okay, be well, everybody. Laila Tov.
Allah Tov.